Enterprise. Cosmic Cubby's arrived. 12 cents admission, still buys the seats where science, myth, and magic meet. From 61 into the 70, exponential growth, holy in humanity. I'm a Babylon.
It's incredible.
I'm a
Welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is January 1970. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, welcome to 1970.
All right.
Wow. We have completed our first decade of Marvel by the Month. That is like four-fifths of a decade more than I thought we would get to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean... I think once we get fully into 71, we'll have a whole, you know, solid for legit, you know, for the people who are counting.
Right.
You know, all the way to August.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. No one can dispute us. but yeah, Marvel, it's a super different company now than it was when we started this show. There's a lot of changes ahead for Marvel in the coming months. So we thought this would be a good time to step back, take a look at what Marvel looked like heading into 1970, and we've got the perfect guest to help us do it. You know him as the writer of What If, Age of Ultron, and Morbius the Living Vampire for Marvel Comics, as well as his own creator-owned titles, Ringside and Shudder. He's the reigning champion of guest appearances on this podcast. He's extending his lead tonight. Joe Keating, it has been too long since I've said this, but welcome back to Marvel by the Month.
Oh, gentlemen, it is good to be back. COVID is cured. We're all reunited. America's amazing now.
It's fantastic.
Everything's good.
Everything's fine.
I feel like we should describe our setup here. We literally have our recording table half in, half out of the studio so that Rob can have proper ventilation.
Yeah.
Because you have tender lungs and we don't want to kill you.
I'm an asthmatic with a previous pneumonia burns in my lungs, or scars, as they like. I like call them burns because it sounds cooler. But yeah,
yeah. And I tell you guys, I would come here under any conditions to welcome the 1970s of Marvel Comics.
Nice.
It's been a huge pleasure being with you guys on the road here time to time. But man, you have no idea how much I was excited for the 70s.
Oh man.
Yeah. So this is gonna be good.
Yeah. So when we were booking your next appearance on the show, and we were going back and forth on dates, you wasted no time in claiming January 1970 as your next episode. You really wanted to be the very first guest to talk about the 1970s Marvel Comics. What is it about the era that just lights your fire?
It's so dang weird. It's so dang weird, and people were just getting away with, like, my favorite comics period are ones where you're like, hey, I shouldn't have this. We've talked about this before. Yeah. Like, B, my parents are going to get real mad. and yeah, so I'm getting away with something. And there's an era at Marvel at the time where, so like 1966, Esquire had written about Marvel. And so it's been a few years now. People know Marvel. The Spider-Man shows out. And, you know, I don't know how involved Stan is in most of these books, which we'll talk about, you know, momentarily. Like, Rolling Stone UK had just written about Marvel. Rolling Stone US was about to in about a year from now, Marvel-wise, or where we're at. And then the young fans from 1961 were getting old enough to become professional writers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of names will be coming up a lot over the next, I mean, however long this is, the years that we're talking about this, or I don't know what time period is to go through the 70s. But, you know, Roy Thomas, Gary Frederick. So you're having a lot of guys, and then like guys like that, and then guys like Steve Gerber and Steve Englehart and Jim Starlin, who are doing a lot of weird, cool stuff. And especially someone like Gerber, who was doing it under such conditions no one was paying attention to what they were doing. And so, which we talked about a little bit when we talked about Howard the Duck. But, you know, all that. And also, it's like 70s New York.
Yeah.
Are the conditions. So this is like, you know, the Deuce 42nd, you know, Street and, you know, the Grindhouse theaters. And it, comics have always tried to scam children out of their money. Like, that was always a thing.
Yeah.
But the ads in 70s comics, especially, are so off the wall bonkers that it's like, that's even just the entertainment on their own. And, you know, I mean, proof's in the pudding. Like, look at Marvel's current movie slate. What are we getting into now?
Yeah.
Master of Kung Fu, The Eternals. I mean, all this stuff is, you know, it's got legs. And the 70s in general, I'll taper this off real quick. But for comics, whether it was Marvel in the 70s or like Kirby's 70s output, where it's like 10,000 ideas per page, you know, you've got a lot of young, hungry creators, you know, who are like skirting the edge of being in the underground scene on very mainstream comic books. And so it's this alchemy of just brilliance and, yeah, great characters, ideas, and just like, and I mean this as a high compliment, but comics is like this, like the most high art trash media.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And just, it's so brilliant and I love it. So
this feels like, Satyricon, which is what, like, it feels like a club where all of the best people are coming through, nobody knows, and it's tiny, and they're doing the weirdest stuff and they're trying stuff when they're playing there, and yeah. They're, you know,
Satyricon's a perfect example though, right? Because then, like, think about Satyricon now 30 years later or whatever.
It's mm-hmm. not, it's gone.
Well,
it's
no, like, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, Satyricon itself is now, I don't even know what it is anymore, like apartments or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Nursing home or something. Yeah.
But the bands that came out of there, you know, like, I actually went to the last show at Satyricon with the Allreds, speaking of Marvel by the Month family.
Man. Yeah.
And it was the Dandy Warhols, and I forget who else was their opener, but it's like thinking about where that club had started. Mm-hmm. And then you have a, you know, a band like the Dandy Warhols who are close. It's just like the thinking about that. And then where 70s were, again, a bunch of young, hungry people, like creative types who are now creating super mainstream work.
Yeah.
So whose mainstream work they later did is now in the ultimate mainstream of, you know, not certain too much terms quality wise, but, you know, obviously these Marvel movies have been seen by a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the dominant form of movie blockbuster, right?
Right,
now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my mother-in-law is going to know who the Eternals are.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so bizarre. Like, I won't have to explain to my mom what a Celestial is.
And, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Which I tried, it, much to her chagrin, many times in, over the years.
Yeah. Well, and on that riff, like, so Disney's What If series just wrapped up, mm-hmm. And it basically ended with an Age of Ultron riff.
Yeah.
And then we're just a few months away from Jared Leto's Morbius coming out into theaters. So how does it feel to be the driving force behind Marvel's TV and film adaptations now?
I'm not really supposed to talk about this, but Joe Quesada showed up to my house
with
a mask. Him and Dan Buckley, they all showed up in a limousine at my house.
Oh,
they gave
so
me a,
nice of them.
It was like the big novelty-sized checks they give out for, you know.
Balloons and everything. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, all my old friends came, and it was great. It was really weird, because I'll be honest, folks, I'm pretty behind on a lot of the Marvel media stuff coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did see Shang-Chi, and that was pretty sweet.
Yep.
But yeah, someone sent me a What If, and it was like, hey, good job. And I was like, what? I don't know. So anyway, that was cool. I'm not credited, but, you know, whatever. Like, you do these things, and then, you know, they become something. I mean, like, when you do Marvel and DC work,
mm-hmm.
I knew that going in.
Yeah.
So the point is, it feels cool, and I'm glad to have contributed some small part. And, you know, I mean, really, though, with What If, I would credit guys like Roy Thomas.
Yeah.
It's nice to be a small part of that stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. Your DNA is in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
No credit.
Yeah. Right.
But little DNA. No,
you get that warm feeling of having been a part of something, and that's all you need, kid.
That'll keep you going.
Well, Joe, we're so excited to be talking to you about the Marvel Comics of January 1970. Before we do that, though, as we always do, we got to provide a little historical context for what was going on. So, Rob, why don't you tell us what was happening on January 1st, 1970?
Yeah, the National Environmental Policy Act was signed into law by U.S. President Richard M. Nixon,
Milhouse,
and went into effect as the first comprehensive environmental protection legislation of the 1970s. Also, Beatles by the month on the 3rd of January, 1970, the final recording of a song by the Beatles took place at the Abbey Road Studios in London for inclusion on the group's last released album, Let It Be, as Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr completed a song written by Harrison, I Me Mine.
Wow.
There you go. Here's some more music news, which also has some finality in the story. On the 4th of January, Keith Moon, the drummer for The Who, ran over and killed his bodyguard and chauffeur, Neil Boland, while intoxicated and fleeing from a hostile crowd of English youths in Hatfield, Herefordshire. Boland had driven Moon's Bentley automobile to the Hatfield so that Moon, his wife, and two friends could attend the opening of the Red Lion Discotheque, and Boland had gotten out of the car to keep the crowd away. The death of Boland, who was dragged underneath the Bentley while Moon was trying to drive away from the scene, was ruled to be an accident by investigators, and Moon, who would die of a drug overdose in 1978, was never charged with a crime.
Yeah, he was never the same either after that wow. incident, so yeah. That could have led to even more drinking. As you know, I like insane drummers, so yeah.
You could just say drummers.
Oh, there's some understated drummers that they're not for me.
List begins and ends with Max Weinberg.
Max Weinberg is everything drummer, though. He's the best. Yes. So yeah. On the 7th of January, a controversial episode on the CBS police drama Hawaii Five-0 was broadcast for the first and only time. Titled Bored She Hung Herself, the evening's offering was about a girl who was believed to have hanged herself, but, quote, was she under the diabolic influence of her mystic boyfriends, or was it murder?
See, this is why I love the 70s.
This is it. And it gets weirder. The theme of erotic asphyxiation was described for the first time on television. And after a viewer died trying the same technique, the show was never rebroadcast and would be omitted from the syndicated reruns of the popular series. In 2007, Paramount Home Video would release a set of DVDs packaged as Hawaii Five-0, the second season, purposefully omitting the word complete. In 2013, the set of Blu-ray discs for season two would come with the disclaimer that the 1970 episode, quote, has not been rebroadcast or released in any manner since its original airing and is not included in this collection because of viewer reaction following the original telecast.
Whoa.
So I didn't know Hawaii Five-0 was, you know, part of the dark and banned arts of so much heavy metal that I love too.
Yeah. On the 10th of January 1970, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced publicly that it would continue to exclude people of African descent from being able to serve as priests in the LDS Church. The president of the church, David O. McKay, stated that non-white persons were not yet ready to receive the priesthood for reasons which we believe are known to God, but which he has not made fully known to man. In an accompanying statement, McKay also wrote that sometime in God's eternal plan, the Negro will be given the right to hold the priesthood. President McKay passed away 8 days later.
Unrelated.
Yeah.
That's what I don't love about the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of, there's downside.
Yeah.
On the 14th of January, 1970, the United States Supreme Court ordered the last 14 legally segregated school districts in the United States to integrate by February 1st. The largest segregated school districts were those of Mobile County, Alabama, with 73,504 students, the 67,000 students in the Birmingham suburbs of Jefferson County, Alabama, and the public schools of Jackson, Mississippi.
3 years before Rob's... Is this...
Yeah.
Yeah, 3 years before Rob was born on January 15th, 1970, and 6 years before I was born, Michael James Brody Jr., who had inherited $26 million at the age of 21, announced at a press conference in New York City that he intended to give away a large part of his fortune to anyone who needed the money bad enough to come to his rented home in Scarsdale, New York. After 3 days of giving away thousands of dollars to strangers, he called a halt to the plan and said that he had made the announcement while he was tripped out on drugs.
Again, the 70s.
And we're back.
It's a lot of ups and downs, but yeah. Okay. On the 19th of January, G. Harold Carswell, a Florida judge for the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, was nominated by U.S. President Nixon to fill a vacancy on the United States Supreme Court. Although the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI had done a background check, the vetting failed to note that Carswell had other problems. Within 2 days, a reporter at a Jacksonville, Florida TV station located a published 1948 speech where Carswell had declared that, quote, "I yield to no man in the firm, vigorous belief in the principles of white supremacy." So 2 months later, U.S. Senate hearings revealed that more than half of Judge Carswell's rulings were reversed on appeal, leading to the odd defense by U.S. Senator Roman Hruska that even if he were mediocre, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. Aren't they entitled to a little representation and a little chance? Carswell's nomination would fail to win the approval of the U.S. Senate in the vote taken on April 8th. Not enough internet to help spin that thing into gold.
Nope.
Yeah.
Hey, here's something with topical and local relevance. On the 22nd of January 1970, comic book artist Alex Ross was born right here in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey. I had no idea he was a Portlander.
Me neither.
Yeah. And then 6 days later, in January 28th, 1970, African-American tennis star Arthur Ashe was denied a visa by the white minority government of South Africa, effectively prohibiting him from competing in the South African Open Tennis Championship. Because at the time, South Africa's white minority government had laws prohibiting whites and non-whites from competing together in athletic competition. It's just, I mean, there was a lot of this stuff floating around in 1970, but seriously, like, there's so much in the Wikipedia entry for January 1970. It was just
painting the whole decade.
Yeah, yeah. You should see the stuff I left out.
Yeah. On the 30th of January, the People's Republic of China made its first successful test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. The Dongfeng, or East Wind, had a range of 2,800 miles and was China's first two-stage missile capable of carrying a 1 megaton nuclear warhead.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Wow.
So that's a glimpse into what was going on in January 1970. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the comics of January 1970 right here on Marvel by the Month. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Marvel by the Month. I hope you're enjoying it. We always enjoy recording with our buddy Joe Keating. We always go super long when he is our guest. So I guarantee that however long this episode is, there is a bunch of stuff that didn't make it into this version.
But there's a way to hear the whole thing. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and support us at the fantastic price of $4 per month. That gets you access to our bonus feed of episodes, which contain extended versions of almost every episode from this season that features a guest.
And we've had some amazing guests this season. In addition to our pal Joe, we've had guests like Mike Allred, Clint McElroy, Chelsea Kane, Tom Brevoort, Elliot Kalin, Douglas Wolk, and the Hines brothers from Screw It, We're Just Going to Talk About Comics. Not to mention subscriber-exclusive bonus episodes and Rob's live recording of Rick Jones' first musical performance.
Don't miss it. Each and every week, Patreon subscribers get additional content you can't hear anywhere else. Sign up at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth to instantly get access to all of our past, present, and future subscriber exclusive content. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's start talking about the funny books with Fantastic Four, number 97. It's the one's titled The Monster from the Lost Lagoon. It's by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby with Frank Giacoya doing the finishes.
It's by Jack Kirby.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you can smell this by now after 9 years.
Jack has signed the paperwork with DC Comics.
And he saw a movie. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about how horror influences are creeping into Marvel Comics. Yeah. In the last few months, we've seen a modern take on Frankenstein and Silver Surfer, the debut of Agatha Harkness in Fantastic Four, and a number of other examples. This is the latest one, which is clearly the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah. And this is something, and Joe, you can probably speak to this better than we can, but like a lot of what Marvel's doing right now is not superhero stuff. Like the industry in general is kind of like, you know, the superhero stuff, it's like, wow, we had a great run with it, but everything's cyclical and maybe kids want monsters now. Maybe kids want horror. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of mythologizing about what Marvel Comics was. And, you know, we've talked about it, especially when we talked about like the Spider-Man magazine and like the context of Martin Goodman's publishing empire and all that kind of thing. And I would argue there's also some mystification of it, right? So like now Marvel Comics, and I get why, is seen as like this impenetrable monolith of superhero comics, which is great. I love a lot of them, you know what I mean? But it's not what it was, really, you know? You know, it, actually, if you see in that August 1961 hardcover that Marvel did, there's one or two superhero comics in there, and the rest of it is horror and westerns and sci-fi, and that's what comics was until relatively recently. Like, in the scope of the history of comic books, it was a much more diverse by genre medium than really the last, I would argue, 40 years, right? So, like, from the 80s, you know, onward. And so... And for whatever reason that is, I've got a lot of theories, and we can get into them. But yeah, especially in the 70s where the comics code starts getting looser and they're like, oh, wait, we can do vampires kind of? Like, I don't know, what if he's an energy living vampire? Like, we can make that happen? Like, whatever, you know?
Pteranodon with jorts? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There was a little bit more integration. As like, oh, they're like, all right, we did the Spider-Man magazine. Maybe that wasn't so hot, but I don't know, what about Planet of the Apes? Like kids like that, let's see what's going on there, or like Dracula, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it has kind of held comics back a little bit because people have the perception that that's always just superhero stuff. And again, like, this is a guy talking who loves superhero. I love Marvel Comics so much, but there's so much more, and there's so much more to Marvel. Like, a lot of brilliant work. Like, I'm coming into this episode with an agenda, and it's showing that my agenda is to really. Shout from the rooftops about some really brilliant work that I just don't think is getting, I don't think it's been recognized since it's been out. And we're going to talk about some specific stuff today.
Nice. Yes. So, yeah. Okay. I'll keep rolling with this. So this story begins with Reed, Johnny, and Ben on the water looking for a humanoid monster who's been sinking ships in the area. They're attacked by a whale and forced to abandon the hunt, or maybe a porpoise. It's hard to say.
There's porpoises on the splash.
I was going to say, there's a killer splash page of the Fantastic Four swimming with the dolphins. Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
I mean, it's literally a splash page.
Yeah. Hey! Whoa! So the monster is clinging to the whale and rides it to an underwater cavern. There, the monster uses its last vial of a solution that allows it to change back into an air-breathing humanoid figure. And then in its human guise, the monster has a job as a fish trainer at a local oceanarium, and he's afraid the FF is on to him.
I love that the monster has a job.
Yeah, I did not expect the monster to have a job, and Jack really threw a twist in there.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think they mentioned at some point how weird it is that he never speaks, but he does speak. He just doesn't speak around
people.
Any other people. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
He does speak initially, and then he's just sort of mute. But
And he looks a little bit like Jack Kirby when he changes into his human guise.
Yeah. So. And I feel like also Jack probably went to an aquarium when he had moved out to California. And that was there were two parts to this inspiration. One, he saw a movie, and two, he went to an aquarium.
Yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon was, you know, airing late night on TV. It was a 1954 movie, so it was in syndication. Yeah.
Well, I'm mentioning this because I'm going to contrast it when we talk about a later book. Mm-hmm. But when I say it's by Jack Kirby, I'm not trying to slam Stan, because like, I used to be a hardcore Jack Kirby did everything, blah 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 kind of guy. Yeah. And then I realized, and because I frankly learned a lot more, it's not the case. Like, Stan had a major role in Marvel Comics, and it would not have been Marvel Comics without Stan as well. Okay, but you can tell at this point in time, Jack sending the pages in, and they're pretty much done. If you look at his original art, really from the beginning, but especially at this point, the dialogue's a lot of it's written in the margins. And I imagine, like I was saying earlier, you know, Stan's been involved with all sorts of other stuff, getting TV shows going. You know, we talked about the Doctor Strange episode. They were pitching TV shows left and right. Mm-hmm. You know, so he was occupied otherwise. So I think it's like, all right, like Jack is pretty much done with this book. He's only got a few more issues left. You can tell he's on his way out. Mm-hmm. He's sending the pages in. Stan's like, fine, whatever. And he's like, all right, like I'm drawing like 8 books right now. You know, I'm gonna like, he doesn't know I'm going to DC yet, which I'm not sure the timeline there, but let's just say that's the timeline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whatever. I like Creature from Black Lagoon. My kid thought it was cool. Like, all right, you know, I'm going to get it in there. You know, I went to the aquarium.
Yep.
You know, there's an issue.
Yeah.
That's Fantastic Four.
Pay me. Yep. That's a pay. There's pages.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like, I mean, how hard do you have to twist Jack Kirby's arm to get him to draw a monster comic?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Like, he can do these in his sleep. And maybe,
I'm not disparaging it.
Yeah.
There's actually a couple things in here that are really cool
that I really want to mention. Stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the summary points, oblivious to the trainer's real identity, the day job of the monster, Reed enlists him to help them explore the undersea caves where he correctly assumes the monster is living in. So the trainer leads the FF into a bog, trapping their boat, which he smashes his way out of. Ben rescues Reed and Johnny and makes it to an air-filled cave, which just happens to be the creature's lair. Good job, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Ben tussles with the creature, and Johnny drives it off with his flame.
And that reveal of the when they discover the creature in its lair, it's a full-page splash on 15. It is like legitimately, it's like it's a little whoa.
Yeah,
like,
it's spooky. I thought it was like I really wish I had the single issue for this because I'm curious what it was like. But if that was a left hand page turn, I would have jumped out of my seat. Like,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Legit, like that was one of the moments where I was like, whoa,
like a jump scare,
total jump scare.
Yeah,
you know, and it's such a hard thing to pull off in comics.
Yeah,
but I mean, Jack Kirby, of course, does it. So.
Yeah. And I'm trying to phase out. I just used the word spooky. Trying to phase that out.
It's still, October. Let's do it.
It's tough. Been doing eerie and weird and yeah.
I love it.
You can wear creepy in.
Yeah.
Let's get all the Warren magazines.
Now that they're in the lair, Johnny's driven off the creature with the flame. Reed, Ben, and Johnny track the creature to a conch-shaped spaceship, which it's filling with water to sustain him and his mate on their journey home. The FF watch him take off, realizing that he wasn't such a bad guy after all, apart from all of the ship sinking and whatnot.
Yeah. They say it's like, oh, he's probably just trying to defend himself.
He doesn't understand our ways.
Right.
But see, that's why I love about Jack, because anyone else could have just done a Creature from Black Lagoon, whatever. Don't worry about it. But he has that cool like little twist at the end where it's not exactly what you thought.
Yeah.
You know? So
he's an alien. Mm-hmm. That's like, I love that.
Yeah. That spaceship is great. I mean, it is a spaceship from an aquatic dwelling race. And it looks like a giant seashell. Like,
yeah, it looks as masterful as like, you know, when we first saw Atlantis, with Kirby and Submariner.
Yeah. I don't want to speak ill of anyone, but like, I do wish we had Joe Sinnott inking this one. Just because by this point, he's so in sync with Kirby. Like, I think some of the stuff would have popped even better. I mean, Giacoya does a good job, but it's sort of like one of those things where, you know, once you have had the Joe Sinnott experience and once like Kirby and Sinnott are in sync with each other, it's like, unless it's like Mike Royer or someone, it's really hard to go back.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm going to be the apologist I usually am on the show. It's like, I just imagine it was like, again, Jack was pretty much, I mean, he was always on time as far as I know. He was known for that, but I still imagine they were just like, well, we just got to get this inked.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you've got a weekend to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
exactly. And Sinnott had taken a break. He was totally burnt out at this point. So, like, yeah, I'm sure it was because I think Giacoya does like 3 or 4 other things this month, too. So, you know, he hustled and he got the book done on time, which is job number one. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. So, gentlemen, we just talked about a few of the superhero comics that Marvel put out in January 1970, but Marvel's putting out a lot more than just superhero stuff at this point. The issues that came out in January of 1970, Marvel published 21 books, and only 12 of them are superhero comics, and one of them is a reprint book. So that means that there's a bunch of stuff that they are putting out there that has nothing to do with what we now consider the Marvel universe. To use like Douglas Wolk's rubric for whether something counts as a Marvel universe comic or not, he's like, could Spider-Man have conceivably appeared in it? So, and the stuff that we're going to talk about here in the back half of this episode is stuff that Spider-Man did not show up in and could not have shown up in. So, Joe, tell me a little bit about like what you were really hoping to dig into with this month of comics, and what do you think is like something that folks don't really understand about Marvel's output.
So I love that Douglas Wolk rubric, right? And like that rule, because it's so true, because there's a lot of history of the Marvel universe, and I totally get why that is. But a lot of history of Marvel comics gets to the wayside, and a lot of it either is just being reprinted now or has never been reprinted again. And there's so much brilliant work in comics, period, when no one thinks anyone is looking. Right, when the young and hungry, or even like the guys who aren't getting work anymore, it goes to this day. There's so much cool stuff happening in independent comics. People are crowdfunding, you know, and they have like 300 people crowdfunding it, and so much brilliant stuff. And it's similar to here, like a lot of these books that normally would not get talked about when you talk about Marvel Comics, like a lot of amazing stuff is happening. And I'm so grateful that we're doing it with this month, because I feel this month has some of the best examples of that going on. Because, you know, you're right in that in the 70s, Marvel tries out a bunch of stuff, but the history of Marvel Comics has a lot of stuff. I mean, Millie the Model was one of the longer running books, right? I'm a big Western guy. Longtime readers know that. Or like, I love Nick Fury, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, and a lot of that stuff existed, even though we're not talking about it. So it's a huge treat to actually be able to talk about it.
And some of it arguably, you know, crosses over later, but it mm-hmm. takes a while, and it's always like in special cases. If a Kid Colt is going to somehow cross over with the Ghost Rider on the horse,
right,
in a really special, weird, or multi-dimensional traveling story,
right.
Which they've done some of, which I think should have happened right out of the gate. Like mm-hmm. by this point, the Marvel Universe could just cross-pollinate wherever,
right?
Like,
right.
You know, but it doesn't, and right. it's so weirdly like walled off.
Yeah.
And it still is. I mean, by what is available on Marvel Unlimited is also a pretty good indicator of what they're getting scanned in. You know, mm-hmm. the fact that we haven't read Sergeant Fury in a while mm-hmm. Because it's not there.
Yeah.
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 And just to give a sense of like, here's like some of the other things that Marvel was putting out. I'm looking at the page right now on Mike's Amazing World of Comics, where it lists all the January 1970 newsstand releases. So there's three books that are Millie the Model related. There's Millie the Model, there's Mad About Millie, and there's Chili. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, two cowboy comics. There's Kid Colt Outlaw. There's Rawhide Kid. Kid Colt is reprints this month, and Rawhide Kid is original story. There's Chamber of Darkness, which is like a horror mystery type comic, a suspense comic
that they just started. It's like, this is issue 4.
Yeah.
So they've just started it back up, something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. There's a couple of war comics. There's Captain Savage and there's Sergeant Fury. And there's our love story, a romance title that again, they just started up. It's issue number 4.
And that stuff may have started up, but don't forget like Journey into Mystery. What did that start off as?
Right.
Tales of Suspense was based off a radio show about, you know, the mysteries and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then it became what it became.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Strange Tales was a pulp, you know, and then it became what it became.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in a way, this, a lot of these like titles they're trying out now is kind of going back to their roots.
Yeah.
You know, and then stuff like Millie, of course, has been going on this whole time.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and this is, again, like the cyclical nature of how Marvel was approaching things. I mean, I think, Joe, you said it before, is like Fantastic Four, number one, is not the first. How did you put it? It's Marvel's first reboot.
It's, comic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that they went back to the well. What's like superheroes were popular in the 40s. They were popular in the 50s. Maybe they'll be popular in the 60s.
Well, they'd sure try in the 50s. Well,
popular is a strong word.
They were something.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, and I do, and I get why you guys, or again, Douglas, you know, starts off with Fantastic Four, number one, because that really is the start of the Marvel Universe.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Like, I totally get that, you know. Although, of course, you could argue that, you know, Namor and Human Torch, yeah, meeting was really the start, but whatever.
Yep.
We all know what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So let's dig into some of these. And the first issue, we'll talk about Chamber of Darkness, number 4. So there's a, I'll just kind of give the overview here of the stories that are in this thing. It's an anthology comic, classically like Tales of Suspense, like Journey into Mystery. There's 3 stories. There's one called The Monster, which is written by Jack Kirby. The art is by Jack Kirby, and he's inked by John Verputin. There's a story called The Man Who Owned the World, written and drawn by Tom Sutton. Denny O'Neill does the scripting on that. And then there's a story called The Sword of the Sorcerers, written by Roy Thomas, art by Barry Not Yet Windsor Smith, which is sort of a taste of things to come for those two guys. So
I loved this one the most. I just finished, Brian got me the is it Dark Horse that put out the Weird Science,
yes,
like volumes, so like hardback, yeah, collections of old EC stuff. So it's just like some hand selected Weird Science tales for 300 pages. It's so great and huge size. But this, I just finished those, and then seeing like Kirby do like this horror story that he wrote and drew is awesome. Yeah, and to realize like what he's doing over in Thor and Fantastic Four right now, but he's also doing this story.
Yeah. So this issue is a particularly great transition for a couple of reasons. So with The Monster, this is one by Jack Kirby. Now it's interesting if you look at the credits, right? Because in Thor and Fantastic Four, Stanley's credited as the writer, and it's pretty surface level. You can kind of tell Jack just turned it in. Now in this one, Stanley's credited as the editor, and it's script and art by Jack Kirby, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's killer. It's such a great story. It's a gut wrencher, and artistically, it's so brilliant. And it's a cool transition, not just from like, you know, what was going on, the superhero stuff, to some of these weirder Marvel books, but also if you compare this to what Jack later did in The Demon and Black Magic at DC, you can see the roots of it in this story here. And so I suspect, you know, A, it's the one where he's getting the credit he well deserves. Right.
Yeah.
And so he's like, all right, fine. You know, like this is I'm going to try out stuff. And again, this is all conjecture, but I'm going to try out stuff, and it's awesome. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. This is planting the seed for Etrigan.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also just like the way the old people look, like there's an old man on page 3, like the second panel, like that guy looks like a background character. Even the way the horses look compared to the horses in the King Arthur stuff in The Demon, like you can tell he's formulating what that stuff is going to look like. I don't know if he had the idea for The Demon at the time, but for wherever he wanted to try out with his art, you can tell he's doing it here.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of this looks like Latveria too, like the little township kind of thing.
Yeah, and it is like every square inch of every panel is just, the detail is ridiculous. And you know, he's being inked by John Verputin, who, you know, not no slouch certainly, but I mean is not known as like one of the great Kirby inkers. But it's like you can tell that Jack is really, he's putting some time and attention into this that maybe is not, you know, happening in the superhero books, which is most, you know, maybe he's more interested in just kind of getting those out the door. But, you know, like the splash page that this opens with is just absolutely gorgeous and creepy and atmospheric. And
it's like classic Macbeth witches with a cauldron and the cauldron has like Kirby crackles just on it, like to sort of define its shape. And then there's crackles in this cloud of fire that shows this one-eyed monstrous face. It's just, I would love to have this be my wallpaper.
Yeah. And I feel like this, it also has like some Kirby themes in it, which is, you know, like the danger of mob justice. And, you know, like the main character is an outsider. He's like this monstrously deformed man. And he's resented by the local villagers because he lives in a castle and, like some calamity has befallen this village, but he seems to have prepared for it better and is like living a better standard of life than the villagers are. So they resent him for that. He's ugly.
He's not quite John Merrick, the Elephant Man level, but he's he's ugly. He's deformed.
Yeah. And, yeah.
And they, of course, but he dresses well.
Yep.
And they resent him for it.
Yeah. And yeah, so he goes into town to get this music box that he's commissioned. And he brings it back to his castle, and he's just getting grief left and right from all the villagers there. And they basically torment him. They chase him out of town. And then they spy on him, when he gets back to his castle. And they see him through the windows. They see him playing the music box for a woman who's seated at a table. And they immediately leap to the conclusion that, well, he must be holding her captive.
Right. She's beautiful. He's ugly. It's got to be a captive.
Right. Yeah. So so a mob of them winds up breaking into the castle, and winds up killing him to rescue her. And that's when they discover that she was just a mannequin. And they just basically murdered this completely innocent man.
The way they're talking themselves into attacking him, saying things like, there may be only moments left before he offers up his victim to Satan.
Yeah.
Those are so... This is so awesome.
Yeah, Satan will be a big... Satanic references, some more overt than others, will be a big theme over this next several years worth of Marvel by the Month episodes.
Tickles a lot of work in the 70s.
Tickles my fancy, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is, you know, sort of... It's your classic, you know, what, 7-8 page, you know,
yeah,
with the twist ending, you know, story. It is like, you know... The classic EC type stuff.
Yeah. Or for people who don't read comics, it's like Twilight Zone episodes, sure, or something that you might be more familiar with. Yep. You know, it's just these are where those came from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's the first story in the book. And then we got one, The Man Who Owned the World, basically, again, sort of a very Twilight Zone-y twist ending. Extremely wealthy guy commissions a suspended animation machine, and basically puts all of his resources toward that, and like sends the world into economic chaos because he liquidates his assets so quickly.
This is like Rupert Murdoch suddenly
pulling
out all of his money from all stock exchanges and whatever else, and or from his corporations, and then just saying, I'm out.
Yep.
And they're like, could you maybe give us some money to help stop climate change? I'm out.
Yep.
And yeah.
And so so it works. He gets his suspended animation. But then when he awakens decades later, it's on a dead Earth, and he finds out that everyone else on Earth was able to get off the planet because of the investments that he made in his suspended animation machine. The scientist was able to figure out a get off Earth plan. I feel like I have read a version of this story, like it doesn't credit as an adaptation or anything, but I swear, like either in like one of Marvel's maybe like 50s suspense, like one of the Ditko things, or I mean, it just it
I feel like
as
they
very,
rehash
very familiar.
These kind of themes a lot. I mean, these things in EC, in Weird Science, in horror stories. This is more like a Weird Science, but
yep.
Man, Tom Sutton too, there's some super trippy awesome art, which also is like, again, we've been nudging towards that, and Neil Adams has been doing a little bit, but since Ditko left and Gene Colan, especially with Gene Colan leaving and Doctor Strange going out, I should say Gene Colan's still working on stuff, haven't seen something that's cool and trippy like page 5 of this story has him falling into suspended animation with all these waves of color around him, and it's very poppy. And then when he emerges to find the barren Earth and the plaque, the giant monolith that says thanks for all the donations from this guy, we got off the planet, and that scene is just super cool and very like Ditko-esque. And I mean, for people who've read these Marvel comics, it's got this Gene Colan, like it's just so psychedelically trippy.
No, it's a total trip, and it's cynical, and it has a grit to it that you would not normally see in, say, a Fantastic Four of this era.
Yeah,
but again, they needed 7 pages to fill. Tom Sutton will do it, and I mean, I loved it. Again, it's a familiar story, like you guys said, but the way that he tells it, again, in only 7 pages, is extremely impressive. And
written by Dennis J. O'Neill.
Yep.
Yeah, he did the script. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I believe Tom Sutton winds up going on. He jumps to Warren and winds up basically being the first artist on Vampirella, and is basically like defines that character. Yeah. So like, I mean, going back to, again, what you'd mentioned earlier, Joe, is like a lot of these guys, they're just like up and comers. They're young guys. Yeah. Like no one's really paying attention to what they're doing.
Yeah.
Or it's like, hey, we just need someone to do 7 pages. You can write and draw. Awesome.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Like, you'll get it done by Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Such a fun playing field. Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about the third story here?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's only a few points, but there's a lot to talk about if we want. This one's called The Sword and the Sorcerers. It's written by Roy Thomas with art by Barry Not Yet Windsor Smith. The story opens with the Conan-like star, the Slayer, fighting the evil wizard troll in the world of Zardath. I just also love all that because it sounds like your brain's having a seizure as you say everybody's name, as it should when you're talking about this stuff. After 3 pages, writer Len Carson wakes from his dream about Star, Troll, and Zardath. He's been dreaming all of the Star the Slayer stories that he's written, but he's finally going to kill off the character before they drive him mad. I love this kind of story. It's like the Dark Half or something.
Right.
So as he's walking to mail his final manuscript, he's attacked and killed by Star the Slayer. Then Star wakes up in Zardath with the memory of killing his most deadly foe in a strange land.
Yeah. It's just, we have seen the evolution of Barry Smith. Like we saw him show up for that first issue.
Daredevil. He showed up filling in on a Daredevil issue.
He did a couple of issues of Daredevil. He showed up for an X-Men. His first story was an X-Men story that looked very rushed, and apparently he was drawing on a park bench because he didn't have anywhere to be. He just got to America and didn't have a plan after that. Just had this like extraordinarily primitive, very Kirby-influenced art style, and it's like already, and that was, what, 2 years ago? And you look at the stuff like, his art in here, that splash page that opens this, is incredible.
It's starting to look like exactly what you think of if you think of Barry Windsor Smith.
Yeah.
I have a theory on the story that I would love to run by Roy Thomas, which is I'm convinced. So about a year or two later, they get the license for Conan the Barbarian. My theory is that they did the first 3 pages of this as a test to get the license to do Conan the Barbarian comics.
I can totally see that.
And then maybe it wasn't like, they don't know if we're going to get the license or not. Because not only, I mean, yes, it does go to the modern day, but there's a general shift in the, and not even like bad or whatever, but in the quality of line work between those 3 pages and the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I wonder if Stanley was like, well, we have 3 pages of this barbarian thing. Could you make the rest of this work?
Yep.
You know? And then they turn it into this, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. And it's cool because again, you see the prototype of what, because Star Slayer's Conan the Barbarian. I mean, he's got the same helmet. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just colored green.
Yeah,
you know. So it's like otherwise, it's the same dude.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, and so. That was something that, you know, Marvel at the time, even from a production standpoint, they used every part of the pig.
Right.
Know? Like there's a lot of speculation that all those pinups that used to run in the back of like the early '60s Marvel comics, like it was. Like, this is a character pitch that Jack drew up to present to Martin Goodman. You know, it's like, hey, this is a book we want to launch. You know, so, yeah, and it was just that sort of thing. It's like, hey, this is what Namor could look like if we bring Namor back.
And then later it's, we need one more page.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yep. And it's like, well, you already did this, and this way we don't have to pay you twice.
Yep.
Or sometimes even once.
At all. Yeah.
At all, probably more likely. But yeah, this I just love that this story too. Like this whole book, I'm like, you know, I want Spider-Man to appear in it so that we can be covering it. But I know there's going to be enough crossover that we can justify that's coming up because, you know, Deadpool was king of the monsters for a while. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So that's their suspense book. That it's one of the two that they have just recently launched. Let's jump over to a book we have mentioned before, but I don't think we have covered a single issue of it. And that's Captain Savage, number 19. This one was written by the story is called They Serve in Silence. The story is written by Gary Friedrich. The art is by Dick Ayers and John Severin. So, I mean, Joe, I think actually you were the first person who brought to our awareness the fact that there was a Marvel comic called Captain Savage.
Yep, you brought one, a full real copy over for us to see.
Yeah, yeah. As I recall, I saw it in a bin and I was like, what is this? Yeah. It was just one of these things where I just had never heard of it and I had no context for it, but it was a Marvel comic starring, and I love war comics.
Yep.
And so I was like, oh, I gotta see what they're like. Because I think I was like, have you guys heard of it? Like, you guys know what this is? Right. Did I find a comic from this alternate dimension or whatever?
Yeah.
You know? And I haven't read the whole run, but what I've read is awesome.
Yeah.
And this issue is incredible.
This is a wild issue.
Yeah.
It's also the last issue.
Correct.
Of
yeah,
Savage. Yeah. Yeah. Which I didn't realize until I got into the end. And then it sort of, like, the beginning of the story and the end of the story made more sense,
yeah,
putting it in the context of that. But, like, this story starts off with, so it basically, just to back up a little bit, Captain Savage, it's kind of like what Sergeant Fury was to the Army. That's what Captain Savage is to, I think, first the Marines and then, by this point, the Navy.
Right. Yeah.
So,
and it's like the Pacific Theater. I mean, yeah. And granted, of course, Nick Fury does get the Pacific Theater a little bit. But,
sure, sure.
But yeah, it's almost entirely focused on the Pacific Theater.
Yep.
Of World War
II. Yeah. And as far as I can tell, Captain Savage never comes back into the Marvel Universe, really. Like, I mean, Nick Fury obviously becomes, you know, the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. and all that. And I don't know that any Marvel, like, mainstream Marvel characters ever cross over into Captain Savage, which, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that this is probably not.
Hydra does.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. But I don't recall any superhero stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. It should still count enough for it to exist, yeah, you know? Once Hydra touches it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if I had to give three reasons for why this stuff has never been reprinted, it's not on Marvel Unlimited, I think the first would be that there's very, very, very little, very tenuous connections to the rest of the Marvel universe. I think the other thing is, like, what is the audience for, you know, war comics, you know, reprints of 1960s war comics. And then, yeah, because it takes place in the Pacific Theater, there's, like, some things that they call Japanese soldiers that you probably,
it's also why Captain Marvel Adventures is not reprinted by DC Comics.
Yeah, like, yeah. Exactly.
You could still, like, there's things they called, like, Nazis, like Fritz or things that are totally still acceptable.
Yeah.
Even Ratsies.
Yeah.
But there are things that are just racial slurs that became that from this point that are in these books. But I don't know if that would have stopped it if there was enough of a crossover.
Well, yeah, and actually, as soon as I said the thing about Captain Marvel Adventures, DC also reprinted all of the Spirit. So,
oh, yeah, and there's some.
I think it's pretty bad, so I don't know.
Yeah, there's some early, some of the 40s and 50s Spirit.
But
stuff
this comic is seriously one of the best done in one war comic. I mean, it's such a great, like, if you want a masterclass in a single issue, here's how you do it. And it because, again, you know, so Gary Friedrich writes it, Dick Ayers draws it, John Severin inks it, and I just have a feeling, again, that Stanley was like, just, we got to finish this book out, so you guys do whatever you want. And it's like a gut wrencher.
It's a great action story. It's a great drama.
It opens with Captain Savage talking about how his wife has left him.
And, okay, that's a good. So the fact that the word divorce is mentioned in a 1970, really 1969 produced and released, actually, Marvel comic, like, that's pretty big.
So,
you know?
So here's something that I left out of the historical context notes, but it was only in January of 1970 for the very first time that you could have a no-fault divorce in America. So, and it was in California first.
Wow.
And so, like, divorce was still an extraordinarily taboo thing.
And it's not hack.
No.
Like, the dialogue, it's right now, coincidentally enough, I'm reading James Michener's Tales of the South Pacific, and this could easily be a story in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it would totally fit in. And when he talks about his divorce and why his wife left him and all this stuff, it really is gut-wrenching. It really gets to you.
Yeah. It's so funny because, like, so there's Marvel superhero comics have this reputation for being, you know, aimed at a higher level of reader. You know, this story is so much more mature than anything that they were putting out across their superhero.
That even college kids.
I
mean, having been through a divorce, I'm feeling, and I understand this character, and I went into reading Captain Savage for this thinking, well, you know, it's going to be like whatever, like the Sergeant Fury and the Howlers on the on water. You know, that's it. And by page three, I'm like watching the main character cry as he's talking about a divorce. And I'm like, oh, geez, it's like, this is really good.
Yeah.
And,
yep.
And I care already about whatever's going to happen now.
Yep. And so on the next page, so it was page three, Rob was just describing it. Page four, he goes to see the submarine, the Seawolf that's been in like pretty much the whole book. And he talks about how it's the only thing he has left in the world, but he doesn't even command it anymore.
Yeah.
It's been taken over by another captain. He's only being allowed on because they're going to do a test.
Yeah.
Right? And so, again, it's like, that's some Hemingway stuff, man. You know, it's like, really?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. There's all this stuff about it's I can't believe they wrote this to wrap this up, because it's about aging, and it's about, you know, middle age, and about your entire career and your life and what it's done. And it's got so much it's context.
Like he lost his family because of his career, and now he doesn't even have his career.
Yeah.
It's like, geez, Gary Friedrich, everything okay at home?
I don't know if so much, like my read on it was he was like, I can do anything I want.
Well, there was that.
Let's do it. You know, no one's looking at Miles. It's the most brilliant work I've ever seen, you know? And like, a lot of brilliant Marvel stuff has come out of that. I mentioned Gerber a million times. I'll mention a million times more. But even like in the early 2000s, when Marvel was like just coming out of bankruptcy, and they were like, I don't know, let these kids do whatever. And you get like Brian Hitch and Mark Miller on Ultimates, and you get the Grant Morrison X-Men.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just like, whatever, just like don't make us more bankrupt, you know? and to be clear, I'm not saying like, oh, editors are bad. Editors are awesome. Editors have saved my tail. In fact, I was working at DC. If Alex Antone let me do a lot of the stuff with Superman that I wanted to do, it could have been a whole situation. But that was an example of a great editor helping me out a lot. Mm-hmm. But I do think there is something to be said for, again, young, hungry, and just like, if there's no editorial oversight on this, Gary Friedrich can write whatever he wants to do. I mean, man, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about how brilliant it is, and we're on page four
of
a full-length book.
Which I did not expect. Yeah. I mean, I've read some good Sergeant Furies, but I did not expect anything other than a standard sort of war epic, you know, or a war skirmish.
Well, like the cliched tough guy, you know,
There's action in it. We'll get to it, but it's mostly the psychological side of it.
Very much.
Yeah. Like the action stuff is about three pages.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it is like the psychological implications of it. So,
which again, I was not expecting.
Yeah. So Savage, this is his last mission on the Seawolf.
It's not even a mission.
It's not even a mission.
It's a test.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his raiders are all off in Australia, right?
So. Right. Yep. So anyway, he takes the test out, and the new captain of the Seawolf is a guy named Will Hite. And he's like, you know, I can just be the captain for this, and you can, you know, it's like you can be nominally in charge. And he's like, no, this is my last run, and they put me in charge, and I'm going to be in charge. And there's this kind of, you know, this tension established right away. So anyway, they wind up encountering this enormous Japanese fleet. It's like one of the largest ones they've ever found. And the boat has to, you know, sink all the way to the floor of the ocean. And the crew has to remain totally silent to avoid detection. But then and this is like the only bit I didn't quite get. Like, I guess Captain Will Hite, like he either trips or it like he has some sort of, I don't know, does he have a tantrum? I couldn't make it out from the art, but
he's having a tantrum and trips.
Okay.
And trips, because I think part of it is like, the ship is either knocked or hit by the wake of the Japanese ship.
Right, okay.
And so it's a little bit of column A, column B.
Gotcha. So he's not being as careful as he should be.
Yeah.
He crashes to the ground, which makes enough noise that the Japanese fleet is able to detect them. And they start... Savage, they drop a bunch of depth charges to try to destroy the Seawolf. Savage orders the crew.
Well, hold on a second. Okay, that page where they drop the depth charges,
yeah.
There's one caption,
three words,
and two sound effects,
yeah.
and the rest of it is silent.
Yeah,
which in Marvel Comics of this era, that's weird.
Yep. Yeah, and it's been dense in other pages, so,
right?
Yeah,
and the fact that it is so dense and so like again into the heads of these characters, and then you get to this. I mean, it's a gut punch.
Yeah, yeah,
it really is, man.
And it's just three big horizontal, three panels. Big,
which again is weird. In a good way for the storytelling of the period of time.
Yep.
It, when I got to that, I was startled.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's gripping. Like, it's just done so well. Yeah. I was not expecting this, again, at all. Like, how this quality.
And so Savage orders the crew to load a bunch of stuff into the torpedo tubes and just jettison it out into the ocean with some oil to try to make it look like they've sunk. And then he gets knocked out as the ship is being rocked by the depth charges. But the Japanese are not fooled by this. Wilhite takes command. He orders the crew to continue running silent for a few more minutes, but he says, look, if the Japanese are not fooled by this, he's going to order them to run, which is definitely going to get them all killed. So you've got a ticking clock scenario, and like the one guy who could do something about it is unconscious. Yeah, again, you've just got this tremendous tension building. And no one can do anything about it. Like, it is the most helpless scenario. Like, you are stuck in a boat at the bottom of the ocean. The enemy knows you're there, and they've got you completely overwhelmed and outnumbered.
Yeah.
Yep. And so Savage comes to in the nick of time. He does wind up retaking command.
He's slapped awake by somebody who desperately wants him to be back in command.
Yes. and then he just he's like, well, we can't run. So he just orders the Seawolf to charge at the enemy destroyer. They as the rest of the Japanese fleet is sailing away, they sink the destroyer with torpedoes and they head for home with intel about the Japanese fleet.
So just real quick, when the pages where they're firing on the Japanese ship is really interesting for a couple reasons. One, it's another mostly silent page.
Yep.
There's two panels with dialogue, and neither of the dialogue is a balloon. In fact, they're kind of written like sound effects, and it's on a 9-panel grid, which is popular. Well, I guess it's slightly off of grid, but essentially it's a 9-panel grid.
Mm-hmm.
The first three panels will correspond, but whatever. For all intents and purposes, it's a 9-panel grid that would really get utilized in the 80s, especially by Alan Moore and Watchmen. And to see it here in a comic in January 1970 shows how far ahead the stuff is happening here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we talked about, you know, somewhat jokingly with stuff that I was working on, but in general, like this, the storytelling on this one page on page 17, like that, the little fraction of that idea is being used by writers now, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen this before and I'm just looking at this and I'm like, oh, okay. That's where that it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you look at the time, like the way he's able to manipulate time, and especially in each it's a grid, right? So you have three, three, and three,
mm-hmm.
and the way he's able to manipulate time over the whole page, but even in three separate strips, I mean, it's just astonishing. And the way, like, you know, so you have panel, I think it's worth getting into if you don't mind.
Yeah.
But panel one, the ship is out there looking at through the periscope, and the ship's further away. And the panel two, it's in the mid-ground, and then it's right there. I mean, that creates a sense of motion.
Turned right at him.
And then the next panel, silent panel of the antagonist, right, looking at, trying to figure it out. Second panel is Captain Savage, then fire one, right? And then the torpedo goes off, then fire two. And then it's just, it gets into another... Which again, this is a little loose on a 9-panel grid, but it's three more panels shooting down the boat, and then the boat sinks, and it's so powerful because you started on a 9-panel grid essentially on page 17, and then you only have the first three panels on page 18, and then the rest again it's loose, but what would be panels 4 through 9, you know, being this one giant image of the ship crashing in a moment of triumph. Which is, you know, obviously thematically embodies Captain Savage just having one last little victory.
Yeah.
Because this is it.
Yeah.
Right? And so, love this comic.
It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is it. That is I can hear like sound effects and soundtrack as I'm reading those two pages, you know, just hearing it go like, doom. Getting to this which is just sort of how I'm translating the emotion I'm feeling, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of talk about you know, I mean, a lot of talk. It's been the way since really the late 70s and through, but really through the last like 2000s and 2010s, 2010s. I'm going to make comics more cinematic. But this shows a show, if you know, you use the medium of comics and the storytelling of comics, you can do something that's even better for this medium that creates that effect in your brain. Mm-hmm. So it's beyond, it's you know, Comic Addict or whatever, you know. It's the more, like, you know, remember Cinerama from the 70s?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where there's, like, more real than real, mm-hmm. like, realer than real. Like, I feel like this is that for comics.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's not them riffing off movies. It's them doing, like, the comics equivalent of Cinerama, mm-hmm. not, like, comics riffing on Cinerama, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's so, like, okay. The opposite of Steranko.
Right.
But, yeah.
And I love Steranko.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, I think he took very specifically... Yeah. Cinema techniques to do what he did, and this is still referencing some of that, man.
Yeah.
And then that last page also is like, what a page to go out on. It's like, after all this like tension and conflict, it is just it's the Seawolf heading for home. It's this placid scene, beautiful aquatic life, like you know, in the entire bottom half of the panel. It's just it's a poster, you know.
Yeah.
Just such a beautiful image. And then it just says the end.
Yeah, and when we think of Marvel splash pages, what do we think of? We think of, like, you know, giant Kirby fists and also like demons and stuff like that, like punching each other across the page or whatever. But with this, it's like a really somber image. And again, I use the word gut punch, but I felt that way throughout this whole issue, you know. And you know, like, his missions are over; he's done.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Brilliant comic.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely love it, Captain Savage.
Good job. 19. Good job, everyone.
Yeah. Yes.
No, it's brilliant. I'm so glad we, first of all, we finally covered an issue of Captain Savage, and I'm really happy that we covered that issue of Captain Savage.
Great. I mean, I don't know if they all weren't great, but I'm guessing this one's got a little more pizzazz.
Yeah. Let's just pretend they did. Well, let's jump on to Rawhide Kid number 75. This one, talking of guys who we have been rude about in the past, this is written and drawn by Larry Lieber, and John Tartaglione does the inks. And it's a really good looking book.
Yeah.
It's well paced and it's like, it's well plotted. I honestly don't have very much exposure at all to cowboy comics. Okay. So Joe, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what we're looking at here.
Well, let me just first clarify for maybe new listeners. I love Westerns like your 85-year-old great-grandfather or whatever loves Westerns. I love them so much. I read Louis L'Amour pretty much every day. Like, I love Westerns, and this is a great Western comic. Mm-hmm. It's, again, done in one. If you want a masterclass on, like, all right, you don't know who any of these people are, and you get into it, even if you don't know who the Rawhide Kid is, you're like, oh, he's a cowboy. Like, fine. Like, I get it. But it's a great tale of like hubris and revenge. And again, dealing with these, a lot like Captain Savage, dealing with these heady themes that are heady even for a company like Marvel, who at the time has the rep that y'all mentioned earlier about being for, you know, college students and people who read Esquire and Rolling Stone UK or whatever. And man, yeah, it's great. It's so good. And, you know, huge props to Larry Lieber. I mean, there's great action. There's great facial expressions. Like,
the
bottom of the page.
The villain looks villainous.
The villain looks villainous. I mean, it's so good. And, yeah, again, total gut wrencher. I will say it's interesting to read, especially these ones where we're able to see the ads in them and see the ads that carry over. Like, again, my favorite aspect of 70s comics are how much they're trying to steal children. Well, comics in general, but really in the 70s, steal kids' money through unscrupulous ways. And you start seeing the origins of that. Like, it gets crazy later on. Like, when you get the ads that are in, like, Son of Satan, for instance, it gets real weird. But, like, you know, I'll make you a master of karate is in this. And then there's the first one is like, you know, it's pretty typical to have like, you know, hey, you were a skinny kid. Now, like, these bootleggy Charles Atlas-y beef up things. And then there's one I noticed that the little bit of like.
You just went by the tiny NFL helmets ad.
Well, there's that. But then there's an ad that's been in a few of these.
I sent some of these.
Playboy Bunny stickers. That it's just like, what? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, hold on. Like, bootleg Playboy Bunny stickers, nonetheless.
We communicate all day, and the surfing helmet that looks like Nazi surplus helmet.
Spoilers for talking about later ads. There are ads for a company, and I want to look up the address now, see if it's the same company, called Adolf's, selling Nazi memorabilia in comics like Son of Satan.
Yeah.
That is just like, again, you know, you study your comics history and you know how desperate everyone was for a buck.
Yeah.
Right. And wow. So they're taking money. It's not called a surfing helmet. I'll send you guys scans later. Like, it's straight up Nazi stuff.
Yeah.
And you're like, and again, I don't think anyone in Marvel Comics was like, Nazis are cool or whatever. I think they were like, fine, just like whatever. Well,
no, you mean a company that was founded by Stanley Lieber and
Yeah, Jacob exactly. Hertzberg, yeah, exactly. Nazis exactly. Cool. Martin Goodman. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, but I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's wow. And it's wild.
I can say in the 80s, my brother and I sent away for all the, you know, like gag things, of course, like Joy Buzzers and Black Gum. But we also, I tried to get the weather balloon, and they said there was like an inflatable Frankenstein.
Oh,
it was
those
like
are 8 feet.
Yeah. Yeah, it never happened.
Yeah. Well, like, so in
they
this.
Just sent you a bunch of swastikas.
Wah, wah. Well, in this particular issue, there's an ad, a half page ad for learning karate. But then later on, there's in 70s comics, there's a thing called the Black Dragon Fighting Society that is like, learn Yakizawa. And I was like, what? What is that? You know? But again, they're just like, fine, we'll just look. We're paying rent in New York, which granted, New York in the 70s rent's not yeah. New York and now rent. Still, probably pretty expensive. Like, just fine. Like, whatever.
Get 1,000 kids to send us a dollar. Yeah.
I want to do a comic called Black Dragon Fighting Society.
Okay, I've got two more ads while we're on this tangent.
Yep.
So the other one I sent to you guys today was Pets. Pen-raised baby raccoons, monkeys, I always say raccoon like because of some British thing, but monkeys, skunks, wolves, and many other kinds and types of pets, hawks, falcons, owls for hunting, reptiles, books, traps, cages, etc. Send $1 for big complete list. Grove Pet Ranch in Grove, Oklahoma. I was like, so that one, and then the last one was the I kept saying nobody loves the Hulk. Great new rock song on 45 RPM stereo record, plus second hit Better Things, available only through this ad. Send $1 postpaid to Queen City Records. And it's Hulkerific. And I looked this up. It's a song by the Trolls, I think. And it's not that great, but it's pretty good. It's and Marvel did sign off on it. So it's like a Hulk record with Hulk on the front and just rock band and the lyrics on it. And I sent all that to the guys earlier today too, but it's
and if we get just 5 Patreon subscribers, Rob will record the cover.
I'll re-record this song. Yeah. Maybe we should set the bar higher for that.
Yeah.
Like 20. But yeah, it's all these scams. It's so it was so nostalgic to see when I saw the ads pages as we looked at these, I could smell the comics more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is something about you know, I mean, obviously the books we're talking about now are not on Marvel Unlimited, so we had to turn to the darkest recesses of the internet to find them. Because as Mark Miller says on the internet, every day is free comic book day. but yeah, they're scans of the book. So like you get the, you know, you can feel the texture of the paper and the, you know, you get all the ads and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, I'm still inclined to go the legit way when we can. But, you know, hey, if Marvel's not going to take my money for reprinting these, you know, there's other ways to access them.
Yeah, and we're incidentally promoting other Marvel comics. <It's> like, sorry, guys.
Well, I hope it does, you know, lead to at least some of these getting reprinted. I mean,
yeah.
the work in here, it's so tragic that it is kind of largely forgotten, because I do feel like this is one of the best examples of what Larry Lieber really is capable of.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know? And like when we mentioned the action, we mentioned the facial expressions, but just like the mood of it, you know, like there's a panel so it's panel, the page layout's a little wonky, but I like it on page 18, but the third panel on there where it's Rawhide Kid, everyone thought he was dead.
Yep.
And so, he's confronting the guy who claims to have killed him. He's had to steal back his guns, and now it's ready for like the shootout. Like, oh man, the mood of that is just, I'm just like geared up. And then it goes on page 19 to a two panel of the shootout, and it's just, it's awesome. Yeah. It's so good. Yeah, I absolutely love this one cover to cover.
Yeah. So, and we should also mention in the shootout, because you know of the era and the comics code and all that, no one actually gets shot. All the you get the guns shot out of the hands.
Yeah.
So right. or if there is any, it's some of it is ambiguous enough that there's just big clouds of smoke, so you can't really tell.
Right. But I mean, I think it works. You know, it creates the ambiguity of, like, you know, especially in westerns about, like, you know, who's actually, like, morality, for instance, and it's like, right, it's kind of left up to the reader to fill that in. And I love it. I love that kind of thing.
Yeah, so. That's pretty cool.
This is a great, like, I my brother and I were just loved the Lone Ranger when we were growing up, both in any form. Like, so if there was a comic book, the TV show, like small crappy novels, whatever, we would read anything about the Lone Ranger. So I do love this genre, but the thing about the Rawhide Kid is this one story, this could be a movie or and you don't need to know, you just get that the Rawhide Kid is good and that he got shot by some guys that were cowardly, and and doesn't matter, the story just stands alone, knowing nothing about the character.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, I think with the roots of a lot of westerns, right? I mean, most of it is short stories, right? You know, you have the Penny Dreadful kind of westerny stuff, and then the pulpy stuff, and you know, the comics. Like, my favorite westerns are the ones that are like done in one, and like, you know, bare bones stories of revenge, and again, morality tales. Total brilliant example. Of a great Marvel Western.
Nice. So.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks so much for going on this tour. Let's go ahead and wrap up talking about, you know, looking at stuff that might not otherwise have dug into, and make a couple recommendations of things that our listeners can check out that are not Marvel comics from January of 1970. I will lead off with a recommendation that I think may have been recommended before by Rob. I think
it's one of my favorite comics.
But I'm going to second it, because I am just going back through all of it, because it is, as we record this, it is just before Halloween, and it's a great Halloween read. I'm rereading The Goon by Eric Powell.
Nice.
So in the spirit of talking about great comics that don't fall into the superhero genre. The Goon, it's a creator-owned series, which I think says something about how it came to be and why it works. It's written and drawn by Eric Powell. He's been publishing for almost 25 years now. Sort of slapstick, ultra-violent adventures of a big lug named The Goon and his mouthy little sidekick, Frankie, as they run sort of a benevolent underworld in a cursed town that's crawling with zombies and hobos and mutants and witches and such. Is really genre-defying. It's just this great singular vision. It probably is not for everyone. It certainly isn't for kids, but I love it. He is reprinting the first run of The Goon right now in these very affordably priced omnibus editions called A Bunch of Old Crap. It's a great way to get up to speed very quickly. So I am seconding Rob's recommendation of The Goon from many months ago.
Yeah. I was thinking about this, like, one, because Joe's here, I brought over Ringside and Shudder, both of those runs, to get him to sign them, but those
are going right up on eBay.
And I've recommended them both already. So, just read them. Like, Shudder to me is a massive, just generation spanning epic that is, that does what comics should do, which is everything.
Yeah. So it's one of my favorite comics. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you just mentioned Eric Powell, and I think we both got this, but he just did the artwork for a bio about Eddie Gein.
That looks great.
Yeah, and it is. So I've got a hardcover. It was a Kickstarter, and now it's coming out, you know, fully. But it is. So Eddie Gein is the the person who inspired both Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Psycho are one of the people, but he's one of the main people because he did like grave robbing and making things out of skin and of human skin from people and probably murdering. There's a lot of, you know, ambiguity, but he's this dark character in American history of serial killers. And reading that book, it's so well done. And so it's just accounts of what people have said, of court documents, of other things. And what Eddie Gein himself has said when he was in the sanitarium. So it is I was expecting something way more graphically crazy based on Eric Powell's work in The Goon.
Right. Right.
It is graphic. It's like terrifyingly horrific. I don't know how to, but the way it's put together made it demystified so much of that legend that it made it seem more, made me better understand the fractured mind and life of this person. And, it was a weird journey for me, and I recommend it for people, especially people who are interested in this kind of like really dark material and this dark history. But did you hear what Eddie Gein done? Came out in hardcover in August. Eric Powell, of course, helped author and did the art, and Harold Schechter is the author. So, yeah, recommend it. Just if you're into this, the dark edges of American serial killer history and all of this sort of horror movie inspiration.
There you go. Awesome. Joe, you got a recommendation for us?
You know, yeah. So I was thinking a lot about briefly touched upon the cool work that's coming out now. That would not, like, you know, companies like, for instance, Image or Boom, or, you know, they do a lot of interesting stuff that's outside of Marvel and DC. And I highly recommend I mentioned Frontiersman earlier. Rain Like Hammers, but Brandon Graham was also great. But
I just picked that up.
It's so damn good. Yeah. Mm. But I got to say, there's a lot of comics that, you know, like, you know, you mentioned that Gein thing was crowdfunded. But there's so many books that are in that circle that I really feel have the potential to be, who knows how long their influence were going for. And I think the one that exemplifies that the most to me is Rich Tomasso's Black Phoenix. I don't know if you guys checked it out. Rich Tomasso is a cartoonist whose stuff I've loved. He did a book called Dark Corridor at Image, and he did a book called She-Wolf, and did one called Spy Seal. But he's doing it's a one-man anthology. He does everything. He writes it, draws it, colors it, letters it, does all the ads all by hand, and it's brilliant. And it's all these different stories. So like, he'll do an issue that's a Halloween issue, and there'll be, you know, like kind of like a Stan Goldberg, Al Hartley kind of looking fun thing that has like a weird twist on it. He'll do a superhero thing. He'll do a detective story, and it's all one guy. And whoa. Rich Tomasso's like a guy
flipping
who
genres with what he's doing.
Yeah. With what he's doing. Oh. And some issues cover a range. Some issues are more thematic. There's an issue where he's riffing off the Golden Age of Marvel. And there's an issue where he's riffing off the Golden Age of DC. And it's all original characters. It's cover to cover brilliant. And, you know, there's a lot of books like that. Like one, if I can mention one more, Jay Stevens, who you guys probably know from Jet Cat Comics and Land of Nod. He's doing a horror book that's drawn like, Dell Comics. So it's in that kind of like Richie Rich sort of looking style, but it's all like psychological horror. And they're called Dwellings, and they're awesome.
Wow.
And so
Casper,
yeah.
The unfriendly ghost.
No, but totally. It's totally. Oh, and Harvey. Harvey was the other publisher I was trying to actually think of. Harvey comics that are in that horror style. And it's so good. So yeah, Rich Tomasso's Black Phoenix, Jay Stevens' Dwellings. And actually one more that's so, if you like this weird dives into history, Jarnar Cootie, who you probably know from BPRD. Mm-hmm. He has an amazing Patreon. That's him talking about his personal history in comics or guys he knew. When Richard Corbin died, he had a huge piece on Richard Corbin. That is such a great deep dive. So those are my three things. One once more, Rich Tomasso's Black Phoenix, Jay Stevens' Dwellings, and John Arcudi's Patreon. Those are like my three favorite comic things going on right now.
Sweet. Fantastic. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Joe, thank you again for joining us. It's always a pleasure, always a delight. I can't wait for next time.
Yeah.
we got to wrap this one up. So I'm just going to say, hey, everybody, thanks for listening to this. If you have not already, consider subscribing to our Patreon for the fantastic price of $4 a month at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and get exclusive content, including the extended version of this episode. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. And if you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review with your mailing address to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth, and marvelbythemonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. And that's all we got for now. So for Marvel by the Month, my name's Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.